Hey, After Buzzers, before we move on to your next topic, we just want to say thanks to our sponsor, Anchor. If you haven't heard about Anchor, it's the easiest way to make a podcast. Let me explain. It's free. Plus, there are creation tools that allow you to record and edit your podcast right from your phone or computer. Also, Anchor will distribute your podcast for you so it can be heard on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and many more. Plus, you can make money from your podcast with no minimum listenership, and it's everything you need to make a podcast in one place. Download the free Anchor app or go to Anchor FM to get started.
I'm Maria Menounos, and you're tuned in to AfterBuzz TV, the ESPN of TV talk. Now, let the buzz begin.
Welcome to this special installment of the SNL After Show here on AfterBuzz TV. I'm Christian Blythe. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at ChristianDMZ. I'll be sitting in for Steph and Amy this week. Joining me is Alan Zweibel, who is one of the original writers on SNL, or as it was called at the time, NBC7 Tonight. He has a new book, Laugh Lines, My Life Helping Funny People Be Funnier. Welcome to the show, Alan. I appreciate you taking the time to chat with me today.
Oh, and thanks for having me, Christian. It's a pleasure.
So there's so much to cover, and for people who know me, they know that I produce and co-host Dennis Miller's podcast, and we had you on there a couple weeks ago. We got some great stories out of you there, some of which I will ask you to repeat here, and I think a great place to start is basically how your career started. You were slicing deli meat by day, but writing jokes by night, and I think who you were writing them for, but most importantly, how much you were getting paid for them. Even at the time you were getting paid is fascinating.
Wow. We can spend a whole show on that. When I graduated college, I moved back in with my parents. I thought I wanted to go to law school. The law schools were convinced they didn't want me. They said, no, it's not necessary for you to even think about it. So yeah, I moved back in with my folks. Always wanted to be a comedy writer. You know, back then, it was 1972. They had no idea how to do it. There was no internet. There was no YouTube. There wasn't anything that could be either instructional or, it was a vacuum. And I started writing jokes for comedians who worked up in the Catskill Mountains. The Catskill Mountains, prior to the time I got there, was the breeding ground for new comedy, new comedians, people like Red Buttons and Buddy Hackett and Tody Fields and Dean Martin and Jerry Lewis, Alan King. They all started there and went on to have these glorious careers in television in Las Vegas. And so that was also the breeding ground for comedy writers, because when they got their break, they took their writers along with them. By the time I got there, anybody who was going to become a big star had already moved on. I was left with the guys who unfortunately weren't going to make it. Great comics, but they were all the same person. You know, they had a name either Freddie or Morty or Dickie or Lee, and they all looked the same in tuxedos and their teeth were all the same. They were basically joke tellers, but I started writing for them. And since you asked, they paid me $7 a joke. That was the going rate at the time. And I did it while I was slicing God knows what at a deli on Hillside Avenue in Queens here in New York. So I would, if something hit me as funny or if they gave me an assignment, I would write it on these little bags. They were called number two bags. They were all numbered. The smallest one was the one they used to sell cigarette packs in. So that was it. I would take it, I write it down, and I shove it in my shirt, and then I'd go home and I type them up or catalog it or whatever. So that's basically how I started at $7. And as my jokes started making the rounds in the Catskills, my price catapulted up to $10 and $12. So I was going nowhere fast.
Well, yeah, you want to talk about inflation. I know that when Dennis Miller did Weekend Update, they would take freelance joke submissions. I believe they paid $25. A little bit later, when Norm Macdonald did it, they took $50. When I was an intern, Colin Quinn did Weekend Update, and he paid $100 for a joke. So obviously, between the early 70s and the late 90s, the value of a joke went very high. I only ever sold one, but I did get that $100, and everybody was like, oh, wait, are you going to cash the check? I'm like, of course I'm going to cash the check. I'm still in college. I want $100. I made a Xerox of it and I still have it. But I'm like, what do you do, save the check? Yeah.
Well, in fact, in my book, I have, there's a Xerox copy of the check that a comedian named Morty Gunty had given me. It's a $25 check. I can't remember how many jokes I had to write to get that $25, but I had the same thing. Gee, I'm now a professional comedy writer, and gee, do I save this as this? No, I wanted the $25, which by the time you got your 100, they were probably about the same. And it's a keepsake.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And one funny thing that I know from the book, but also you mentioned this when you talked to Dennis, was that there was a routine you wrote in the early 70s that a comic was still doing, 30 years later?
My wife Robin and I, when we were living in L.A., we moved out there after I'd co-created It's Gary Shandling Show, and I stayed out there and did a few movies, and we were fine and we were well. And a show called Catskills on Broadway came to town. And what that did was it had Freddie Roman, another comedian named Dick Capri, another comedian named Mal Z. Lawrence, and they always had one woman, and it was like somebody like Marilyn Michaels, who was not only very funny, but she was an impersonator and she sang. And it was a fun show where they would basically do their acts on stage, their Catskill acts. It was called Catskills on Broadway. And when we were in L.A., we went to see it. And during the course of one of the comedian's routines, I started whispering. Now, this is 2000, I want to say 3, okay? During one of the comedian's routines, I started whispering the punchlines to my wife. And she said, how do you know that? I said, I wrote that 30 years ago. I said, he's still doing those jokes. And afterwards, when we went backstage, one of those comedians said, you have any notes for me? And I said to that particular comedian, I said, no, I'm thrilled that you're still doing my jokes. I said, but now that you ask, what, you know, the joke about the Secretary of State, you may want to take out Henry Kissinger's name and put in Madeleine Albright. And he's looking at me like I'm talking like a different language. So I continued and I said, well, because unless you do that joke in the past tense, it will sound more current if you do the person who's the Secretary of State right now. And he goes, let me think about it. Think about it? What do you mean think about it? What's there to think about? And months later, I walked into a restaurant and that comedian was there and I saw him across the table. He saw me across the room, I should say. And he stood up. He said, Alan, Madeleine Albright.
I could understand.
There were definitely characters. And yeah. I don't know who replaces those guys. I have a real fond affection for that brand of comedy, where it is in the the sociology, if you will, of American humor. You know, it was a natural progression from vaudeville to the stage, you know. And then when we came along, we were the sons and daughters of those guys and started going to places here in New York like the Improvisation and Catch a Rising Star. And L.A. had the Comedy Store and also had the Improvisation. And it was our turn, you know. But I always had a fondness and a respect you know, what came before us. You know, it's just the history of comedy in a way.
Yeah, and sort of transitioning to the stand-up scene in New York, you know, reading the book, I know that as you're starting out, you have probably one of the best partners in crime, if you will, to accompany you on your drives into
God,
New York,
yeah, I mean,
from Long Island. Someone who has a connection to Saturday Night Live, sort of a complicated one, but he does end up being a cast member in the 10th season. So talk a little bit about how you knew Billy Crystal and what the two of you would do in terms of, you know, going from Long Island into Manhattan to do stand-up.
It's a pleasure to talk about this because it started, let's say, 1974. So if this is 2020, do the math, it's 46 years, right? What I did was I got tired of writing for those Catskill guys. I took all the jokes they wouldn't buy from me because they thought it was too hip for their audiences. And so I made it into a stand-up act for myself. And I went to the places in New York that I just mentioned, like Catch a Rising Star or The Improvisation. And my plan was to go on stage, tell the jokes, with the hopes that a manager or an agent or somebody would like the material. I didn't want to be a comic, would like the material and want to represent me to help me get a job as a TV writer, which is what I wanted to do. And the first week that I'm hanging out there, I meet this other guy who's just starting out. His name is Billy Crystal. Billy had been a member of a trio and he had just broken away from them and he was now starting to do a single act. And we became friends right away. I moved in with my parents. It was on Woodmere, Long Island. He lived with his wife and their first daughter, Jenny, about four or five towns over in Long Beach, Long Island. He had a little blue Volkswagen that he would pick me up in every night. We'd go in, we'd tell our jokes, and on the way back, we would listen to the cassettes of each other and, you know, offer suggestions. You know, this joke worked, this one didn't. What if you said this way or that way? And that's how he and I started, you know, and as friends, helping each other. And when SNL came along, I got to be a writer on it, one of the original writers. Billy ended up hosting a show later that season. I think it was show 17, one that Ron Nesson, no, he was a guest on it. Excuse me, he didn't host it. He was a guest on it. And then Billy moved to LA and the friendship endured, but you know, there was no internet, or so we were 3,000 miles apart. When I moved back out there, though, I co-created It's Gary Shandling Show. Billy and I, let's say, jump-started our friendship a few years later. And this was the most wonderful coincidence. Rob Reiner, who had hosted the third Saturday Night Live ever, had created a production company, a studio actually, called Castle Rock. And Rob had been a guest on It's Gary Shandling Show, and we maintained our friendship. And he asked me to come to Castle Rock with a television deal after I got done with It's Gary Shandling Show. I eventually did sign it, a contract with them. And I was sharing a suite of three offices. I was in one, Billy Crystal was in another, and Larry David was in the third. I had met Larry back in those days as well. And we used to sit around going, what are the odds of this, you know? The relationship with Billy continued. We had never worked together. We stayed friends. He was Uncle Billy to my children, his wife Janice and my wife Robin, good pals. And then one day, Billy asked me if I'd like to help him collaborate with him on a one-man Broadway show he was planning on doing called 700 Sundays, which was about his family. The title comes from the fact that his dad used to have two, three jobs, worked 6 days a week, and Sunday was their day. They go to ball games, they go to the beach, whatever. And Billy's dad died suddenly when Billy was 15, so he calculated that he had roughly 700 Sundays with his dad. I said yes right away, and we collaborated on it, and it became very successful. But even more so emotionally, it was a high point for me because here was my pal trusting me with his family, trusting me to put words in those characters who I never met in their mouths. You know, yes, I never met him, but he's a Jew from Long Island. I'm a Jew from Long Island. It's not like I was writing for Martians. I knew who they were, okay?
Sure.
But that was a great high. And then most recently, Billy and I co-wrote a movie called Here Today, which we finished shooting last November. So we got it in before this pandemic closed everything down. And it stars him and Tiffany Haddish, and it's edited. I think they have to finish scoring it a little bit, but it's ready to go whenever there are theaters to show them in, you know?
Right,
so
exactly.
It's been this most glorious, satisfying work/personal relationship.
Yeah, no, and you know, Billy is obviously one of those, you know, huge figures in comedy, and the story of basically him getting cut from the first episode of SNL is first of all legendary, and it's surprising. Before we actually get to that, though, I did want to talk about how you ended up being one of the original writers of SNL. I think the story of Lorne Michaels going to see you do stand up is actually very funny.
Well, he didn't come to see me. He happened upon the place. And it was in the wee hours, and I went straight into the toilet. I couldn't get these six drunks from Des Moines to laugh at the foibles of my Jewish family in Long Island. They just didn't care. And I was about 4 months into this experiment, and I went to the bar, and this guy who ended up being Lorne came up next to me and told me what he thought about my abilities as a stand-up. And trust me, they were less than stellar. Okay. I think he pretty much used the expression worst comic I've ever seen, but he liked the material and asked to see more. And I had a manager, a Borscht Belt manager named Dave Jonas, who was one of the prototypes that Woody Allen used for the character Broadway Danny Rose. He was that kind of guy. And there was an agent at William Morris named Leon Memley. They submitted me to Lorne for an interview for this, to become a writer on this new show. And I showed up at Lorne's suite. He was staying at a hotel in New York, and I handed him a tome of, I guess it was like 1,100 of my, what I thought were my best jokes. And he liked them. He read one joke in front of me, and then ultimately a couple of, you know, he kept the tome so because he could read them all, I guess, and had to show it to the NBC brass. But a few days later, I got the phone call,
and I believe that joke, the one joke he read, ended up on the first Weekend Update, right?
Oh yeah, it did. It was to show you how long ago it was from the reference points. I'd written a joke saying that the post office was about to issue a stamp commemorating prostitution in the United States. 10-cent stamp, if you want to lick it, it's a quarter. And it struck a nerve. But here's the interesting thing. Not only was it on the first Weekend Update, it was an often quoted joke, often stolen joke by comics and whatever. But when I go and I do speaking engagements, okay, and I speak, you know, at fundraisers or corporate events, but when I go to colleges and I tell my story and I tell that joke to 18 and 19 year old kids, they just look at me and go, why would you want to lick a stamp? It's got all the glue on the back. All we're going to do is peel it and put it on.
So it's like a sticker.
It's antiquated.
So the cost of the stamp and also the format of the stamp. Yeah, it's
everything. This is such an old joke.
I love that. Yeah, and I love the idea that you turned in 1,100 jokes, but he only read one. You know,
well, it was in front of me, and it turned his head when he started. It was, but I've since heard, and you know, others have told me that Lorne had said that, yeah, that was the joke that, you know, it didn't take much for Lorne. Lorne is real smart, real smart. And I think he'll look at something and just determine from the sensibility or the ingenuity of writing even the smallest thing and go, okay, I like this mind. No, I don't like this mind. You know, I'm under the impression, and I would have to ask my friend Al Franken, that, you know, he and his then partner Tom Davis were doing stand up in New York, in LA. And I don't know if Lorne ever saw them. I can't remember what it was, but they used to do a routine about a newscast the day after World War III. Okay. And I remember Lorne saying that the minute he heard, I guess it was Tom Davis giving the weather. It was either the weather or the sports. But the item was Bobby Orr fries in Boston. This went okay. So, you know what I mean? It didn't take a hell of a lot to go, all right, I like the way this person thinks.
Yeah. So you end up working on that, you know, the beginning of SNL, but I do love the sort of little footnote in your book of the job you turned down to take SNL, which obviously to a lot of people at that moment, it probably seemed like a sure thing, like, oh, I should take this job.
It was the people who I had told it to at the time, except for my parents, they all thought, everybody else thought I was insane. As luck would have it, and I'm living at home and I'm slicing meat and I'm trying to get my a foothold. The same week, literally, that I got the phone call about Saturday Night Live, I got another phone call telling me that I was offered a job to write the questions and bluff answers for Paul Lynde on the Hollywood Squares. And as it happened, you know, right now it sounds like such a ridiculous to put those two things in the same sentence. And why would that, what's the problem? Why would you even give it a second thought? But at the time, the Hollywood Squares was going into like its ninth season. It was an established hit. It was on the West Coast where the whole industry is. It was prime time, which meant a huge audience and a higher pay scale. And all of the, you know, stars that were in the boxes all had their own variety show. They all had their own Las Vegas acts. And this would be an entree into the business. Whereas the Saturday Night Live thing, 11:30 to 1 on Saturday night, who's watching television? You know, it's only people who can't get laid. They're watching television, you know. And East Coast late night, which was a ridiculously low pay scale. Who's John Belushi? Who's Gilda? What is this? Okay. And I had a dilemma for about a second and a half. And I went, no, this is everything I've always wanted. These are my peers.
Yeah.
We have the same sense of humor. Even if it doesn't work, this is what I want to do. And so I chose that, you know, and who knew that 45 years later, that same show would be on the air. I mean, it's just an amazing accomplishment. It's an American institution. Yeah. And boy, you know, when we went to the 40th anniversary show, which is now 5 years ago, and more recently, Robin and I, we went to a show, the last live show they did before the pandemic hit,
right.
Okay, before they stopped, Daniel Craig was hosting it. And even then, I'm just looking around, remembering everything, you know, very nostalgic. I met my wife on that show. And going into that studio, whether it was for the 40th or that other show we went to a few weeks ago, just the memories that you're hit with, that I'm hit with, you know, I still see Belushi swinging a samurai sword and Gilda walking around with a can of tab and, you know, some of the writers who have since passed, you know, Tom Davis and Herb Sargent, Michael O'Donoghue and, you know, and most recently when we went to that last show, my friend Buck Henry, you know, so it's filled with a treasure trove, if you will, of most wonderful memories, you know?
Yeah. And, you know, look, as somebody who only has those memories from watching TV, like being in that studio for the first time, I interned at SNL when I was in college. This was, let's say, the beginning of 1998. And then I was also a page at NBC. So I used to give tours of that studio.
So who were the cast back then?
It was Will Ferrell. Norm MacDonald had just been fired off Weekend Update, but he was still on the show. So Colin Quinn had taken over. That was the first show I did, was Colin's first. So I kind of got in good with him. He knew my name because I submitted jokes. And, you know, you're talking about your 1,100 jokes. I would turn in like 45 jokes every week. And I did sell one eventually, but it was just like,
but it doesn't take long to get to 1,100 if you're doing 45.
Right.
A week,
yeah, exactly.
Right?
So Will Ferrell, obviously that's the breakout, but Jim Brewer, you know, that it's that crop. It wasn't even their first year. It was probably about the third year of that crowd. So they were settled in. The story that breaks that first week, I mean, Monica Lewinsky's the big story that week, you know? So it's
can't even imagine.
It's a pretty ripe period. You know, there were shows that were, were shows that were on vacation at that point. Shows like The Daily Show, which was hosted by Craig Kilborn at the point. There were shows that all came back from vacation because they're like, wait, we can't let this go.
Yeah.
So it was a great time to be there. And, you know, most of that cast was so great and they were nice. And every once in a while, you know, somebody that had been a past cast member would show up. And that was always exciting for me just to have watched on TV. And when I was a page at NBC, I actually did the 25th anniversary special. So that's how long ago it was. But I got to talk to Billy Crystal that day, and he was just like random. The dressing room we put him in was his old dressing room, and he was talking about it, you know, all the stories from when he was in the cast, you know, which was basically right when I first started watching it live. You know, the reruns used to be on Nick at Night, but that, like, Billy Crystal, Martin Short cast, that was the first time I saw what the show was, you know.
And Larry David was a writer on the show.
Right? Larry David was a writer and
he didn't get one thing on the air.
Yeah, and that's where the story for Seinfeld came from, because he quit one Saturday after the show and then panicked on Sunday and then came in again on Monday. And he's like, didn't you quit? And he's like, no, I was just joking. But he
made like nothing happen and just kept them going.
That's what I loved about Larry. Back to the original cast, I love the story, you know, about you first meeting Gilda and just how close you were with her, you know, throughout her life, but also just writing with her. And I love the story about basically, you know, you were trying to not be seen and she gravitated towards you in the office.
I walked into this room, to be exact, was July 7th, 1975. And my dad manufactured jewelry, and his place was in New York, 52nd between 5th and Madison. And I used to run errands for him. And as a little boy, even no matter where the errand had to go, I would go by way of Rockefeller Center. I'd go into 30 Rock into the great lobby there, because, you know, Johnny Carson was upstairs doing The Tonight Show. There was a show called That Was the Week That Was that starred, among other people, Buck Henry. So there were people up there doing what I wanted to do someday. And here it is, X amount of years later, and I walk into that same lobby and I am doing it. And I go upstairs to my first meeting as a TV comedy writer, and we go into Lauren's office where everybody was assembled to discuss what this new show is gonna be. And I look around and I see Belushi, and I see Aykroyd, and I see Franken and Lorraine Newman. And I was a big Jewish joke writer for the Catskill Mountain Comedians. I had never heard of Second City at that point, let alone the Groundlings. I didn't know about improv. I was brand new. I was green. And I see these guys on their feet just kidding around and being funny in the moment, playing with each other. And I'm going, oh God, there's no way. There's no way I can compete with these people. And I got scared. And there was an artificial plant in the corner of the office. Maybe it wasn't artificial, but I went behind it and I hid. And the meeting starts. And then I heard a girl's voice at one point say, can you help me be a parakeet? And I went, the hell? And I parted the leaves and I looked at it, and it was Gilda. And she told me about this idea she had where she thought it would be funny if she stood on a perch and scrunched up her face and spoke like a parakeet, needed a writer to help her figure out what the parakeet should say. She asked me if I was a good parakeet writer. And I had no idea what she was talking about, but at least somebody was talking to me. I said, I'm a great parakeet writer.
Of course.
Eventually, asked me if there was room behind the potted plant for her, because it was her first TV show and she was nervous too. And it's there that we met and started this, what became a 14-year platonic love affair, if you will. And we wrote a lot together. And you're right, even beyond the show, the friendship continued. Yeah, there was a little lag time. Because when we left the show after the fifth season, I got married to Robin. We started a family, but we stayed in New York. Gil eventually moved out to L.A. and married Gene Wilder. And so there was no internet. There was no emails. The three-hour difference became a thing. And so we were sort of in touch, but not really. It, you know. And then when I went out there to do its Gary Shandling show, I wanted to jumpstart our platonic friendship. And she would say, yeah, she would accept a date. And then at the last minute, she would always bail on me. And I got pissed off. I remember calling Robin and saying, I don't think Gilda wants to be my platonic friend anymore. And, you know, and I've always thought that even at the beginning, you know, platonic friendships, you know, it's usually one person in the friendship who doesn't want it to be platonic.
Sure.
All right. If these are the rules, I'll live with them now. But one day you'll see the glory that's sitting in front of you. And she told me ultimately after Robin had spoken to her, Robin told me to call her. And Gilda said that she was sick. And she had Epstein-Barr virus. And she said, you know, my mind wants to do what it's always wanted to do, but my body just won't let me. And she asked me when I would be coming back out to LA. And we had just shot the Shandling pilot. And I said, well, the show gets picked up as a series. I'll be out in about 6 weeks to hire a staff and to start this show. So she asked me to call her when I came out in 6 weeks. 6 weeks later, I went out there and she came by. I rented a house in, you know, LA, you know, status. Okay.
Sure, yeah.
No matter whose house you rent or whose you buy, the bigger the star is, you know, the better, you know, it is for your own status. I had rented a house from Larry Fine from the Three Stooges. Okay. So, wow, I'm moving in, and these big burly guys are moving in rented furniture, and Gilda shows up at the door unexpectedly with a housewarming gift, which is a big potted plant, and we brought it in, and we got to talking. I told her how pretty she looked. I asked her how she felt, and she said that she just found out she didn't have Epstein-Barr virus. She had ovarian cancer. And I asked, what should I do? How do I help there? And she just said, make me laugh. And that became my role in my platonic friend's life. When she got sick, I'd call, tell her jokes. Gary and I would do a show every week, send her a cassette like it was a Hallmark card. And she eventually appeared on its Gary Shandling show, which was, they thought she was in remission, and it was a very triumphant return. And the audience, 300 people, did not expect her to be on. We didn't announce it. And they were very emotional when she came on the set, and it was really great. And as a matter of fact, Gary and I and Gilda, she was feeling good. We have it here somewhere at the house, notes, because for HBO, we were going to create a show for Gilda, which was like, backstage at a variety show. So let's, like Carol Burnett. So you see Gilda, who's the star of the show. You see her at work, you see the sketches, you see the writer's room, and you also follow her home. And we had two or three meetings, and then ultimately she wasn't in remission. But once again, I had to make my platonic friend laugh. So I went to the hospital, I went to Cedars-Sinai to give blood. And I'm on the gurney, and a nurse comes over and gives me a pad and a pen. And I go, what's this for? And the nurse said, well, Gilda likes to know whose blood she's getting. Write her something nice. She's having a tough time. So I wrote, dear Gilda, I knew I'd get some fluid of mine into you one way or another, which pretty much sized up the whole relationship, you know.
Yeah.
I hope I answered your question.
No, you did. No, absolutely. I love that answer. And I love reading about Gilda because, look, there's no shortage of talented women who were on that show, not just in that cast. I feel like Lorraine Newman is wildly unappreciated because of how great she was when you watch that show. And, you know, look, a lot of her sketches aren't necessarily, you know, when you cut the reruns down to half an hour, there's so much that comes out of a 90-minute show.
Sure.
And so I think that when you get to see the longer versions, it's like, oh yeah, she and Garrett Morris, just as funny as everybody else.
Absolutely.
It's just they weren't the huge breakouts. And yeah, if you only have a half an hour and there's a B sketch or a samurai sketch, you're going to put those things in there. One of my favorite characters that she had, I believe you collaborated with her. I don't know if you created it, but was Rosanna Dana. And to me, the funniest thing about that is yes, the way that she falls off, but just it starts something about the name. And I understand from reading a lot of books about SNL, Lorne didn't like funny names, but to me, Richard Fader from Fort Lee, New Jersey is such a funny name. Were you involved in that? Do you know what it was that made that so funny?
I co-created the character with Gilda. Rosie Schuster, one of the original writers and one of the funniest humans on the planet, had written a sketch. It was a public service announcement some weeks before. And the public service announcement was for hire the incompetent. So there were three vignettes of people, of characters, who were highly incompetent, but please hire them despite their maladies and their deficiencies. Gilda opted to use that dialect and that wig for her vignette. And I think she talked about how she was fired from like Burger King because they found a hair in one of the hamburgers that she served. And then she went like that, you know. And that was it. It was a one-shot thing. A few weeks later, I was having dinner with Gilda, and I'm producing Weekend Update at this point. And I said, listen, you remember that character? I said, why don't we move her into Weekend Update, give her a role, a continuing role, and let her do consumer reports. Now, there was, in New York at the time, there was a local newscaster named Roseanne Scamardella. And I said, you know, not unlike Roseanne Scamardella, I just threw out the name of another news person. And Gilda, without breaking for a millisecond, said, can we call her Roseanne Rosanna Dana? I said, yeah, but where'd you get that? There was a song in the 1960s called The Name Game. You put in a name and it was like, Johnny, Bobani, Banana, Fanifo, Fanny, Fee, Five. And so like, like stanza number 12, if you put in Roseanne, Roseanne, Rosanna, Dana comes out or doesn't, but she thought it didn't, and we went fine. If you want to call it that, fine. So that was the funny name that we had given that character. We moved her into Weekend Update. And the first couple of letters that she got that we wrote from viewers that Roseanne would then answer, one was from Doris Powell, who was a secretary on the show when it started. Another one was from a guy named Bob Van Rye, a really nice stage manager. I don't know if he was there.
He continued to be the stage manager while I was an intern, I think until about 2000. Yeah. And he would always do this thing that if you like the first second of the show, you hear the audience laughing because he would do this thing where he would be like, you know, 20 seconds, 10 seconds. And then he would do in a funny voice, like 5 seconds, so that everybody's already laughing when the show starts.
It's interesting because when I was there, he was the second guy. The guy was Joe Dixo, who did
oh
that.
Sure, yeah, I remember his name from the credits. Bob, sure, yeah.
Just inherited that. In any event, by the third, I think it was like the third time we did the character, Gilda became obsessed with my brother-in-law, a guy named Richard Fader, who lived with my sister in Fort Lee, New Jersey.
Oh, I love and that.
I can't remember if Gilda said let's use his name or if I made the third letter from him, that I don't remember, but she loved the name, and that became the name for all the rest of the times that we did Roseanne, Rosanna, Dana. And we gave that character, we made him a character, unseen, but he used to write in and ask the stupidest questions.
Yeah.
And so they were really idiotic. So he had this persona, this unseen character that Gilda would answer every time we did the piece.
Yeah, and then, you know, sort of the reverse of that is Emily Latella, who's this, you know, quiet, reserved, you know, sits there, and then she just always mishears something, and then she goes on, and then the joke was always, never mind. And I would love to see, you know, and even in the reruns, they would usually put just that part of Weekend Update. You would see the big characters. And so I always thought it was so great that it's like, you know, I was like in probably middle school, I was watching these, and just like, you know, starting to understand the kind of range that somebody like Gilda the hat, you know, that and then Belushi would do his things where, you know, he would go on and on about, you know, and Jane Curtin would try and get him to stop, and then he'd have the heart attack, you know. So there was such this wide range of emotions that you would see throughout the show. And, you know, I mean, I think that there were different personalities for all of it. I mean, Chevy, it was just him. But I thought that, you know, you had Jane and Dan Aykroyd, you had Jane and Bill Murray, you know, for, I think that was the longest stretch that they had was Jane and Bill Murray, unless I'm mistaken.
I think so. Yeah. I think it turned out that way. The last couple of years was them. Yeah.
Yeah. It's just so great to see. Obviously that was a part of the show that really stood out to me. Long before I worked for Dennis Miller, I was a fan of Dennis Miller, because I would see him and I'm like, they carve out 20 minutes of the show and they give it to this guy who doesn't give a shit about anything. You know what I mean? And then you go back and you're like, okay, yeah, Chevy was kind of the same way, just, you know, with a sort of a different standard. And I think that it was so smart to have the fake newscast right there in the show. And was Weekend Update something that they always knew, like, we will definitely have a fake newscast, or did that sort of evolve over time?
Well, you know something, I can't remember the exact genesis of it. I do remember that Lorne named it Weekend Update. I do remember I might have been just walking by Lorne and Chevy, and maybe O'Donnell was in that conversation. Walking by, I heard them talking about doing the news. I mean, it was a live show. It seemed like it was a live topical show, okay? So it's one thing to do a movie parody of Jaws or whatever is in the theaters at the time, but here you are at the end of a week. Why not do the news? You know what I mean? To make it topical and take advantage of the fact that you're live. If I had to bet, that was all Lorne's doing. You know, it was his idea. And, you know, Chevy was the guy who did it. That segment was pretty much produced by Herb Sargent. And I contributed a lot because, once again, jokes was what I did. That's what how I got to the show. So I became close with Chevy, came closer with Herb Sargent, and who became like a mentor. We were all like 24, 25. Herb was 54. He was the grown-up. He had produced right. That was the week that was, the show that I had mentioned earlier. And he was a real special guy. He was around... He was a New York writer around the time that TV came into existence. And he was best friends, and he had written for Steve Allen. And I'd go into his office, and I'd see Ben Bradley there. I would see Gloria Steinem. To know Herb Sargent was to be 2 degrees of separation from the rest of the world, you know? So, it was Herb. This older guy who came up with Generalissimo Francisco Franco is still dead.
Right.
But he would also write jokes that he didn't care if they got a laugh or not. He would write jokes in 1975, 1976 about what we now call climate change. And his philosophy was, if they laugh, fine, but if they don't, well, the fact that you bothered to tell a joke about it maybe will make people sit up and go, gee, this must be a thing. You know what I mean? So he was very well aware of the power of a joke, whether it got a big laugh or not.
Yeah, and I know he was with the show for a while because he also collaborated on Weekend Update with Dennis. And, you know, it was basically Dennis and Herb Sargent wrote like 95% of the jokes at that point. So, you know, by that point, he was 10, 15 years further in there. In the book you talk about, there are a few times where, you know, it was so current that you were actually under the desk feeding jokes. I want to hear about that in general, but I know that one of the times is kind of this most infamous show that they did, which was the Live from New Orleans show, where everything basically went wrong.
Well, you know, these days I write books, I write Broadway shows, I write movies, and if I'm lucky, they see the light of day 2 years from now. And here, the first job I ever had was on this live show, where if you write something on Tuesday, it's seen by millions of people on Saturday. If you write something on Saturday, millions of people will see it that night. And I remember what used to happen was we would have the dress rehearsal at 7:30 or whatever it was. in front of a live audience, and you do the whole show. And the show is usually 2-3 sketches too long, right? And after the audience goes, everyone goes up to Lorne's office, and it's determined, this is where Lorne's, one of Lorne's genius qualities comes out. If a dress rehearsal, even if it was like lousy, somehow he would reconfigure the show and it would be good. You go, wow, wow. So get rid of the sketches that weren't going to make it in. The writers would tweak the sketches that we wrote that need a little help, whether it's editing or make jokes a little better. And I would do that with my sketches like all the other writers did. And once I gave it to the cue card guy, whatever the changes were, if there was time, I would go upstairs to the 17th floor to my office and watch news, 11 o'clock news. And if something struck me as funny, I would write a joke and give it to them, and it would be on television a half hour later. The show you're talking about, the infamous Mardi Gras show, we went down to New Orleans during the Mardi Gras, and Buck Henry and Jane Curtin are on a reviewing stand, and the Bacchus Parade is supposed to come by the reviewing stand. That's why it was situated there. And Herb Sargent and Buck Henry and Jane and I are on the reviewing stand. And we had a schedule as to what float would be coming by at what time. And we wrote jokes about these floats. We go on the air live, unbeknownst to us, where's the parade? There's no parade. We start writing jokes about what they would have seen, okay, had that float come behind us. And I remember, and we didn't have any material for this. So I was literally under the desk writing jokes about this non-parade and handing it up to them. Herb was doing the same thing. He was standing. There wasn't room for the two of us. And he was older. If he crouched, I don't know if he would have been able to stand up again. So, but we were writing it, and it was on TV. A minute later, it was, That show was somewhat disastrous for a few reasons, but the thrill, the adrenaline rush of writing something, you had to do it right now because the light's going to come on them in 30 seconds. They have nothing to say. So that was really the epitome for me of live television and how stirring it could be, you know?
Oh yeah, no. I mean, I imagine the whole thing of being on a show that was actually live, where, you know, I mean, at a time where you didn't do much live television anymore. I mean, you know, I'm sure it had been years that since the Tonight Show had been live. You know, I feel like, you know, when, especially once Johnny moved out to California, so you know, you were basically kind of that for comedy anyway. It was really the only live thing, and yet the idea that something's getting on, you know, even the same week is crazy. But yeah, 30 seconds, you know, the ink is still wet and it's being said on the show. That's so great.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's one of the things that a lot of people will say watching the show, even some of the great early shows, they'll talk about, you know, like, oh, you know, this host is so bad because you can tell that they're reading the cue cards. But my understanding, and I assume it was even in those days, they didn't want you to learn the scripts because you had to read the cue cards because the jokes would change. Sometimes, you know, the cue card writers writing it, you know, during the commercial break, changing a couple of the jokes. So that's why you have to read the cue cards. So, you know, the idea of the show being so immediate is kind of, I don't know, probably one of the most exciting things about it. And it's fascinating that you can still watch shows from 45 years ago and you're like, all right, sure. You know, Jimmy Carter has a mustache for some reason, but we don't need to worry about that. But
Jimmy Carter had a mustache. Tom Snyder had a mustache. Whoever Dan did had a mustache.
Yeah, I love that.
You know, and you forgive it because there was something greater going on. And what we were just saying about the live TV, whether it was in the years that I was there or you do it now. I watch the show every week. It's still a high wire act.
Yeah.
It's if something works, great. If it doesn't, well, it's out there. You can't edit. You can't delete. And it's something that's inherently exciting.
Yeah, and I think that, they started doing something out here on the West Coast about a year and a half ago where it airs live at 8:30 our time now.
Sure.
I've got two small kids, so I was never watching it at 11:30. I would, like, you know, record it and maybe watch it during the week. But the idea that I can see it live again is kind of, it adds to that excitement. I'm more inclined to watch it because, one, I'm not going to fall asleep, but two, it's like, well, it's happening right now. That's a lot of fun. The idea that it's live across, or at least the continental United States, I think is pretty smart, because it's like, all right, so there's one less Law & Order SVU rerun, or one less Dateline that airs, you know? So I think the people that don't, that will say things like, oh, you know, I guess I'll watch the show for the first time in 10 years, or that it hasn't been funny. I mean, I don't think that people watch it because, yeah, look, some weeks you're like, whew, that one was rough. But other weeks you're like, there were like four or five great sketches in that. I'm glad that I saw it, you know?
Absolutely. You look at the talent that's every generation, you know, it's had the benefit and the misfortune is not the right word. It reconstitutes itself in front of us, okay? It's not like it comes down, it goes off the air and it gets a new cast and now when they're ready. No, it happens right in front of us. And you know, all of a sudden, John Lovitz comes along, Dennis Miller comes along, Adam Sandler comes along, Tina Fey, Amy Poehler, Rachel Dratch, you know, Kate McKinnon is a gift from God.
Yeah,
you
absolutely.
Know? Cicely Strong, you know, so you go, Cecily Strong, and you go, wow, these people are great. You know, it's really fun. Look at Keenan. You know, it just
Keenan, who's been on, going. I think he's legitimately in his 15th season now. You know, and you'll always hear guys who'd be like, oh, I don't think I'll ever leave the show, but Keenan, like, just loves it, and he's still there, and he's so good. You know, they had I think they called it SNL at Home episode they did a few weeks ago.
Oh yeah, I watched that show.
Yeah, I thought that I was fascinated just by the concept of it. I think some of it worked better than others, but it was so cool to see. And like, there was Keenan being Keenan, and I'm like, well, yeah, of course Keenan's there, you know. And
did he have two kids with him?
Yeah, he did. He had his kids. Yeah.
So it was like, I loved it. Yeah, the concept of it and the spirit of it is what I got off on. Okay, I even wrote Lorne an email the next day. It was so brave, and it was needed. And the fact that you saw Pete Davidson, the basement that he lives in, and Keenan's
mom's house,
kid.
I know.
Yeah, absolutely, and everybody, it's go, wow. I just thought it was great. It was,
Obviously, you know, I think you can't do 20 of those a year, but the fact that they weren't going to be getting in the studio anytime soon, and, you know, it'd be great if they do at least another one of those before the end of the season, because we're not going
to... Do they have plans to? Because I'm unaware. Or do they have plans to do it?
I haven't heard it. I just would like them to do at least one more, just because... That, you know, there's no way they can do the studio show, at least during this TV season. Who knows about in the fall, you know? But it would
be great if what would have been their last show of the season, if they do another one at home where they're saying goodbye and hopefully we'll see you under different circumstances.
Yeah, and there's probably going to be cast members that don't come back next year for whatever reason, you know? So to get one more show for them to shine, I think would be great. Yeah. And I think that's a great example. I mean, there are these huge moments in the history of the show that, you know, the first show after 9/11 has a great big production. You know, you have Paul Simon, and then eventually after about, I don't know, 10 minutes, they get to the first joke where Lorne says to Rudy Giuliani, you know, can we be funny? And Rudy says, why start now? And then you're like, oh yeah, great. It's okay to laugh, you know? And I think the show has a really important role unlike what other shows really have, you know?
Well, I thought that particular joke, you know, why start now? It was so perfect for 1,000 different reasons, like you just said. And just the spirit of this, the acknowledgement of this horrible, horrible calamity, but we're still going to do a show. And then there's that joke. I thought that was one of the most stellar moments. There were a number of them through the show's history, you know. But I thought that one in particular was, wow, that's really cool, you know.
Yeah. And obviously the show premiering, you know, in the very recent memory of Watergate, obviously that sensibility is very different. And it's very apparent just watching those old shows years later, like I did. Like I was very, when they finally put the full episodes out on DVD, I actually bought all of them because I was so excited to actually see the sketches that were the quote unquote worst sketches. And then you see the, you know, the sketch that aired at like 12:50, you're like, that's funnier than anything I've seen in the last 10 years. And that's the worst sketch in the episode. And, you know, just all the bands that were on, you know, to see the full shows, I think from any point in the history, it's such a great, it's really a great time capsule of here's everything that was going on in those moments. And, you know, especially like in those 80s shows when Dennis and Dana Carvey were in the cast, it's all these like MTV bands with like one hit and you're like, oh my God, I remember this band, you know? So it's always great. And the fact that the show is so current, I think, yes, it sort of dates it in the short term. You know, there's maybe some that you don't rerun for whatever reason, but then to watch them even a few years later, it really takes you back in all of those, you know, in what was going on and what was so important at that time. Like there's tons of sketches about Three Mile Island, you know, in the final season of the show, you know, because there was, that was such a big deal.
It's time capsule stuff. It's stuff that reflects a period of time. What was current then? What was the humor about it? You know, when I was there, Al Franken and Tom Davis and then Jim Downey as well, they would write the political pieces. So the ones that you're talking about, whether it was, you know, Blind Faith or the last days of Nixon, or you just mentioned Three Mile Island, there was something called the Pepsi Syndrome, I remember, that Franken wrote with his partner. I had nothing to do with those. I wasn't smart enough. I wasn't politically astute enough to do it, you know. So the stuff I did was more silly and whatever. But when it came to the political parodies, there were certain things that they did. And if you look at them, and you're absolutely right. What was the big book then? What was the big movie? What was going on in the world? Who was pissing off who? Where was there a war? You know, and you go, oh, wow. It's either nostalgic, or if you're first coming to it the first time, it's a history lesson. It's a history lesson in terms of the events, but it's also the fact, how is it made fun of? How is it portrayed comedically? And it's really interesting. It's very, very interesting to look at that, you know, in retrospect. You know, when we went to the 40th anniversary show, my wife and I were seated, you know, in the audience, and we're looking up. And it was a fascinating sort of experience because there was a live show going on with current cast members and a mixture of older cast members and the current ones. Like, so a Weekend Update, there was Jane Curtin and Tina Fey. I can't remember who the third person was. Maybe it was Amy. I just don't
know. Pretty sure it was Amy, yeah.
It was Amy, okay. Okay, so there you had a mixture of the old and the current. Okay, what was then current or the old and the more current. But on the monitors, what you saw at home, but we were in the studio. So while they're changing the sets to whatever the next live sketch was going to be, on the monitors, we're watching old sketches from when I was there, taped up commercial parodies, you know? And it was, you were bombarded by all the different eras. And it was a fun, it's nostalgic without saying. But if you looked at it objectively, you go, oh, that was a thing to make fun of back then. Oh, God, I forgot about that, you know? Whereas what was going on the set, when they changed the set, and this, and what we saw on the monitors when that was complete, we watched and saw what was happening live. And I think the show ran long. It was 3 hours plus, I think. I can't remember. But I do remember, you know, in that very famous after party, it was, and all I remember saying to my wife was, look what we had the good fortune and the opportunity to be a part of. Look, this is really, wow. Look what we were allowed to be a part of. Look what Lorne did. Look at the people who are here. Look who came through those doors. If you were to have some genealogical chart of all the people on the show, you know, cast members, writers, whatever, and what they've done since, and how they infiltrated and became an important part of the fabric of American comedy, American culture. It's fascinating. You know, I had once thought that if you did that with Second City, you would get something similar. But even if you forgot Second City and just started off with the original cast and writing staff for that show, my God, it's overwhelming. You know, and doing this book, Laugh Lines, a lot of the things we're talking about, the nostalgia of it, comes rushing back. And you go, oh, wow. Yeah, chronologically, I remember this. But yeah, but that's when I had a I talk about this in the book. And it's part of the same process. Years later, when we lived in Los Angeles, Rob Reiner has a screening room at his house. And he would show a movie and we would go and watch it. And it was never a current movie. It was always a classic movie. And because he's Rob, he was able to get who's ever connected with that classic movie as a guest there. So we watched the movie and then ask whomever afterwards to dinner to tell us about it, you know? And there was one time, it wasn't a movie. He showed clips from Caesar's Hour and from your shows. And I remember, so the guests of honor, if you will, were Carl Reiner, which wasn't a hard call for Rob to make. Come over Sunday. Yeah. And his wife, you know, and Rob's mom, Larry Gelbart, who was a writer on those shows, and his wife, Mel Brooks, who was also part of those shows, and Sid Caesar himself, all of them and their wives, right? And I made sure that, you know, now while they were showing it in the screening room, these people I just mentioned, they were in the back row of the screening room. I made sure that I was in the row immediately in front of them because I wanted to hear what they were saying while we were watching this. Now, look at the bodies of work that were sitting behind us. And this is 40, 45 years later. Right? And this is what I was hearing. I was hearing Gelbart say, oh yeah, Doc Simon wrote that sketch. And then somebody else would say, yeah, but Woody, meaning Woody Allen, came in and gave him the joke about the raisinette. Okay. Wow. Wow. And it was, we were enthralled. And then after the screening was over and we had dinner and we had Wolfgang Puck. And because Rob is Rob, Wolfgang Puck was actually there preparing dinner for us.
Of course.
So I don't say Wolfgang Puck like as a figure of speech. Yeah. It was the literal.
Actual.
No, he was making dinner. And at the kids' table, if you will, with my wife, Robin, and myself, Tom Hanks and his wife, Rita Wilson, Billy Crystal and his wife, Janice, Larry David and his then wife, Lori, and I think Lovitz came back by himself, but I'm not sure. Okay.
Well, if Lovitz was there, he was by himself, I'm sure.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't think. And we were seated, and it was a masterclass. We were all asking questions, what it was like back then. We had heard this story. Did Sid, did you really pull somebody through the window of a car and say, this is how it felt for you to be born? I mean, did this happen? Did that happen? And I remember afterwards, at this particular time, to show you how long ago it was, Carl Reiner had asked Hanks, because Forrest Gump had come out fairly recently before that. And he said, Tom, how did they do it that feather came down and landed? And Tom just says, no, I'll tell you another time. This is about you guys. You know, it was just, we were like this, you know?
Yeah. And it's, you know, that I'm sure is what it's like for people to go to those SNL anniversary shows. I mean, for me, you know, I referenced that I worked the 25th anniversary and I was lucky enough to go to the party up in what was still called the Rainbow Room. Or I don't know if it's changed its name or not. But anyway, I worked at the party upstairs and asking to sit at my table because she just wanted to rest her feet was Mary Gross, who I think a lot of people might not remember, but she was on the cast with Eddie Murphy. She's probably best known for playing Alfalfa in the Buckwheat sketches.
Sure.
And she was so sweet and she was like, you could just see how much she was just like, I can't believe that this was, you know, I was a part of any of this. And, you know, Victoria Jackson, who was on with Dennis, she was like so nervous about being on TV again. She told me she felt like she was going to throw up beforehand, you know, just sure. So you see that there are those people that you don't necessarily forget about, but maybe you don't think about them as often because they're not Eddie Murphy. They're not John Belushi. They're not Will Ferrell. And there's so many of those people that it's like they have such a great role in those sketches and their stories are just as great. So just, you know, getting to talk one-on-one with Mary Gross, I was legitimately more excited about that than a lot of the other things, because it's like I'm getting this one-on-one time with somebody who sure. I probably even, you know, for her, I probably had, you know, 20 questions I could have asked her. But it's great to see that the show has that role and that importance. And like I could talk to you for another hour, but there's a couple more things that I'll get to and I'll okay. let you go. One thing that I'm fascinated about, I always loved the samurai sketches. Now I know from reading your book that you didn't write the first one, but you did work a lot on them. And I think you actually put in the book, there's a list of samurai ideas you had, right? Talk about how you got involved with it and just what, you know, the way that it's, I don't want to say formulaic in a way that denigrates it. I mean, it's a brilliant formula that works for the samurai. And you know, you just would plug in these different concepts.
Well, what had happened was Belushi auditioned for the show with that character. So it was John's character. And the first samurai sketch was written by Tom Schiller. And it was Samurai Hotel, and it was Richard Pryor's show, which was the seventh show. And it was really funny, and it worked great. And for the 11th show, Buck Henry hosted, who was my idol. And I remember Lauren saying to me, "You worked at a delicatessen before you came here, right?" And I went, "Yeah." He said, "Do you think you can write Samurai Deli?" And I said, "You bet." Then he walked away and I go, "What the fuck? What is this?" I wrote Samurai Deli and it was a big hit. And then I wrote all the rest as well. Okay, the 9 or 10 that came afterwards. That list that you saw in the book was not my list. That was Tom Schiller's list suggesting other samurai sketches. I didn't use one of them. And it had nothing to do with Tom. As a matter of fact, I don't remember that list until when I called Tom, you know, to fact check certain things for this book. I called all the writers. I called anybody who was in the book. I said, "Look, memories differ. Perceptions differ. Tell me if there's anything in here that you don't agree with or is not true and that I should change." And when I did that with Tom, he said to me, "Do you want a list of the samurais that I," meaning him, "wanted to do, but you never did?" So I said, "Yes." So he sent me that list. And I swear to you, Christian, as sure as I'm sitting here, I never saw that list before. He could have done it like during that phone call I made. Yeah. I don't remember it, but I put it in the book in deference to Tom, okay? I wouldn't have been able to think of that series. Yeah, I wrote the deli one and then Samurai Taylor, and it built, like you said, the formula of it. Yeah, there was a formula to it. You had an unsuspecting person walk into an establishment, never acknowledging the fact that there was a samurai warrior behind the deli right. making a sandwich or measuring you for a suit. Okay, that never came into play. It was just accepted, okay? And then it built. You know, I think I go into the book, in the book, you know, this was the early days of, well, it wasn't the early days of television, but there was no cable. There was no Fox. It was ABC, NBC, CBS. And that was television. So we had to expand the boundaries a little bit, use a certain amount of cunning. And I remember that with the samurai, we started putting in different moves, and that became part of the signature of it. And there was one week where I wanted Buck to say something. I can't remember which samurai it was, okay? And then I wrote in the piece, John takes the sword and goes like this in and out of the sheath, as if to say, "Bullshit," okay?
Right, sure.
And the censor, there was a meeting. Now, Lorne was the ultimate person. You went to him if you had a problem. But otherwise, until then, you try to take care of it yourself. And I remember a meeting. It was the sense it was a really nice guy named Jay Otley. So you can't do that. And you go, well, why not? Because it's a jerk off motion.
Right.
You can't do that. And I had put in three, hoping I can get two. He said, you can have one. He still got the lift. Because Buck said whatever. And John went, okay, so it still worked.
Yeah.
So that was, it sounds so tame in retrospect, given how expansive TV is. Forget about streaming. There was no cable then. HBO didn't have original comedy programming. It wasn't until we did It's Gary Shandling show, that Showtime. I think that they had one show before. It's called Brothers or something like that. But Shandling and I, when we created It's Gary Shandling show, it was virgin territory, you know, to create a show that would be on for cable, for a cable audience, because they were looking for filler. Yeah, movies were one thing.
Okay, yeah.
But this was original. And so what I found when I was researching the book and remembering and then trying to verify everything that I remembered, it was, there's a history lesson there. You talk about the history of what was on the air. Talk about the history of seeing old sketches, which were topical at the time. What I try to do with everything here, whether it was SNL or the Shandling show or Curb Your Enthusiasm or this, the play that I co-wrote with Billy Crystal called 700 Sundays, to see how things evolved to what we knew them to be. And in SNL and in Shandling in particular, because it was more widely seen, you know, because it was on television, how things got to where they were. You know, what were the behind the scenes discussions or struggles? And it's really pretty interesting stuff. It was just like that night we spent with Carl Reiner and Mel Brooks, Larry Gelbart and Sid Caesar. I remember as we were leaving that evening, we asked Sid Caesar how many cameras did you have in the studio? I asked that question because I couldn't figure it out from the different angles, and some of them, the compilation didn't have, gee, in that one, they didn't have a close-up from this angle or the two-shot. How many cameras did you have? And his answer was, that depended on whether the Dodgers had a home game or not. There were like seven cameras in New York.
Right.
And if Khrushchev was landing at the airport, one went there. And okay?
Oh,
and,
that's so funny.
And there's a picture my wife has. It was me, Hanks, Lovitz, and I want to say Billy. When I asked that question, and he said that depended on whether or not the Dodgers had a home game, the four of us, the picture, the four shot is all four of us going like that. Yeah, and I looked for it ferociously to include it in the book. We couldn't find it. It's here somewhere. But yeah, so that stuff, anybody who's a student of the medium, whether it's this book or other books about it, how did that come about? How did the medium itself grow to accommodate and make those decisions?
Yeah, and I feel like at some point I could have a whole conversation with you about Gary Shandling. And It's Gary Shandling show, I think, was great. I think a lot of people focus on Larry Sanders' show, but I think that they're missing how great It's Gary Shandling show was. I remember we had Gary on with Dennis Miller on the old radio show when that first came out on DVD. And so I have a set of that, and I watched it because I actually only saw it when they would air the reruns on Fox, because my family wasn't paying for Showtime, you know. We would have the free trial of HBO once a year, and that was it. But and I love that show, but I also love Gary so much. And I remember, like, when I would talk to him before he would be on with Dennis, like, I would get to talk to Gary for like an hour on the phone, just me. I'm a radio producer. Why is he taking the time out? And he was so funny. Even his email address was funny, you know.
Well, like, I need email.
Like,
right?
I need email. And yeah. I was just like, of course his email address is funny. You know, and it was just, I just couldn't believe that. That's, you know, look, it's very small behind the scenes stuff, but I'm like, I'm getting to talk to Gary Shandling. And I knew your name forever because Alan Zweibel, you know, right there at the bottom of the writers list in the reruns on Nick at Night, you're not going to miss that name. And then I'm like, oh wait, that's in the Gary Shandling show too. It's kind of the same time period. So I was, you know, I knew who you were long before I knew who you were because I was like, this apparently this guy's funny. He's, you know, involved in two of the greatest things ever.
Thank you.
The final thing I want to talk to you about, sure. it was the same final thing when you were on with Dennis, but I want to talk a little bit more in depth about the, apparently by everybody's estimation, the Milton Berle show was the worst show of the show ever. And that was why I was excited when they started putting them out on DVDs, because I had read books about this Milton Berle show and they never showed it. You couldn't see it anywhere. And so I finally got to watch it and I'm like, okay, it's not great, but it wasn't like on screen wasn't the train wreck level that I was anticipating. But talk about why that week was difficult. And then, of course, how that week started for you is my favorite story in the book.
Well, what happens, look, I have not seen that show in reruns. Okay. So if it was done 40 something years ago, I haven't seen it. What we all tend to remember is the process. So I have done a lot of things that was successful, but my memory of the process is not that great. It was too hard or it was fighting okay. And then there were things that I, foul tips, if you will, but my memory of it is the process. Oh, that's when I became friends with so-and-so. Oh, that's when we went to Hawaii to do the thing. So you remember the time spent. So what I think, and I can't speak for anybody other than myself, okay? So I can't speak for how bad that show was to watch. But it was a train wreck in terms of process. On paper, it was sort of a poetry, okay? Milton Berle was the king of television. He had the Texaco Hour for that network at television's infancy. Now it's the next generation. And it's, you know, it's Gary Shandling show. Saturday Night Live is similar. It's the next generation. And so there was the old, there was the new, the same. I don't know if he did it in that studio. I don't think he did, but there was a poetry about that, you know, the older and the current. But what came along with the older and the current was Milton, bigger than life sketch comic. He broke character. So if you had a sketch and he was supposed to play someone's dad, he would ad-lib a joke and look at the audience to get a laugh. And you go, no, you're supposed to be the dad. Yeah. You're supposed to be speaking to the mom about the kid. You're not supposed to be. Now, I don't mean that necessarily per se, because I can't remember most of the sketches in the book. There were a couple of accounts that the Rosie Schuster and Ann Beetz give about sketches that they wrote that Milton totally screwed up by breaking character and doing it was subversive in a way. What I do remember, I remember two things. And I'll end with the anecdote that you're craving. The
the audience doesn't even know what they're in store.
They don't even know what's coming in about 2 minutes. what I remember process-wise was we were camera blocking Milton's monologue. And he's on stage, and you know, camera blocking is just rehearsal in front of camera to see what the angles are and whatever. And you usually do the monologue. You always do I suspect they still do. You do that on Thursday because there's no sets required. They're all being built for, you know, so you do those sketches the next day and it's in one. And so Milton comes out and he's got his monologue in his head. And so he's rehearsing and the camera's right there on him like that. And then at one point, and I'm standing nearby, at one point he says to Dave Wilson, who is the director who's in the booth, okay? He goes, Dave, when I get up to this word, okay, here we go again, the raisinette, I would love to have a sound effect of a crowbar falling from a rafter above, landing on the floor and sort of like, you know, reverberating until it comes to a stop. Dave says, why? And Milton says, because at that point, I am going to ad lib. Oh, NBC must have dropped another one. Well, listen to that sentence. At that point, I am going to ad lib. It was antithetical to everything. You had the greatest improv people in the world on this show. And here's a guy planting something that he would ad lib. Later in the same camera blocking, he got to a point where he says, once again to Dave Wilson, I am going to, when I mentioned that I'm approaching or just turned 70, I can't remember what it was, he said, please only shoot me from the waist up. And Dave Wilson goes, why? Okay. And Milton says, because below frame, I'm going to go like this. So the audience at home doesn't see it, but it will prompt a standing ovation.
Yeah, he's signaling with his fingers to actually.
Signaling with his fingers, yeah. Another ad lib. This would be, he's signaling the spontaneous, you know, standing ovation because this idiot just turned 70 or was about to turn 70. So that was, you take that, plus the fact that he walked around, you know, he would call, you know, some of the PAs, you know, toots.
Yeah.
And you know, all these highly sexist things, yeah, but from his generation, you know. So it was it was icky. What had happened, and this is what you're salivating for, before I got the job on SNL, in addition to writing for all those Catskill guys, one of the things I wrote for was when they appeared at the roasts, Friars Club roasts. And they were stag, this was before women were admitted into the Friars Club. These were stag luncheons with 1,200, 1,700, whatever it was, people at a ballroom at the Hilton Hotel. And they would roast somebody. Milton was usually the roast master. That meant he was the MC. And when you did jokes about anybody, you went after whatever their stereotype was. So for Milton, there were two stereotypes. One was that he stole everybody else's joke. So you'd write jokes about that. And Milton fed into that. Whenever anybody, the comics would get up that would tell a joke and they'd have it on index cards. After they told the joke, they would throw it on the floor and Milton would get up and he would sweep up all the index cards. Okay. But the other thing that they used to make fun of and joke about was the size of Milton's dick, okay? And I had to write a number of those jokes. You know, it was like, you know, so big that after his circumcision, they used the foreskin to cover the infield at Yankee Stadium. I wrote a bunch of those fucking jokes, okay? So sure. Now I had worked out with Gilda. She was rehearsing somebody else's sketch. I told her that I would be in Milton's dressing room. She should come get me so we can go write whatever together. I go to Milton's dressing room and I'm sitting on a couch and there's a coffee table in front of the couch. He's on the other side. I'm sitting on the couch. Here's a coffee table and he's standing on the other side of the coffee table wearing a bathrobe, one of those short ones that go maybe mid thigh. And I say to him, just as an icebreaker, it's not like I was coming on to him. It had nothing to do, just as an icebreaker. I'm like, at this point, I'm like 29 and he's 70. I'm looking for common ground. And I say something along the lines. I says, Milton, it's so weird that I'm meeting you now. I said, because for years I wrote jokes about your dick. And now I'm meeting you. I said, if anything, it's usually the other way around. Because everybody used to do jokes. And he, you know, I can't remember if it was Dick Shawn. It might have been the comedian Dick Shawn. Don't hold me to it. But, you know, one time Dick Shawn went into the steam room or the sauna at the Friars Club here in New York and saw Milton sitting there naked. And when he saw Milton's penis, Dick said, "At first I thought he was there with his son." Okay. So big this fucking. So I just mentioned it. He says, "Oh, so you've never seen it?" And then he says, "Would you like to?" And I am somewhere between the N and the O in no. Okay. Where he unparts this bathrobe he's wearing, and he takes out this anaconda. Okay. And he's holding it across the coffee table. Yeah. And he goes, "It's something, isn't it?" And I say, "Oh yeah, it's really something." As Gilda knocks on the door and opens the door, goes, "Wait, Belle," and she sees me looking into this, you know, one-eyed trouser snake, and she goes, "I'll see you later." And she leaves. So yeah, that's when Mill. But and anybody that I've told this story to who may be dubious about it, they realize that it did happen because Milton would show it to anybody whether they wanted to see it or not, as he did with me. He was known for, "Hey, take a look at this."
Yeah, of course. Well, you can get stories like that. And another one that I like that I won't have you tell now is just running into Frank Sinatra at a restaurant. I think that, you know, your daughter's misbehaving and runs up to Frank Sinatra. I think that interaction's great. You get stories like that in Laugh Lines, My Life Helping Funny People Be Funnier. Alan Zweibel has been our guest. And as the end of the interview, I want to ask a final extra question, basically, in that the end of the fifth season in, you know, mid 1980, did everybody know that was the end for all of them? Because the show does come back, but with a very rocky new cast, and it doesn't last very long. And, you know, there's a lot of that's well written about. Did anybody think like, "Oh, maybe we'll come back in the fall," or did everybody know, "No, this is the end"? That last show, I believe, hosted by Buck Henry, when the on-air light goes out, did everybody know that night, like, "Yeah, we're all done now"?
Well, you know something, for the last couple of seasons, towards the end of each one of those seasons, there were always rumors, "Is this the last season? What's Lorne's situation? Is Lorne coming back?" Da, 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 da. But this fifth season, for some reason, and I'm trying to remember, we were more fearful that we wouldn't be coming back. And some of us shared the same manager, Bernie Brillstein, that Lorne did. I did, Gilda did, John and Danny, who had left the show by then, they were managed by Bernie. So we had a little bit of, and when Bernie would tell me or Gilda, "Well, we don't know yet." And, you know, and he didn't want to betray Lorne, so I didn't know what it was. But there was a little bit of paranoia, I remember, about it. Gee, is this the time that we're not going to come back? So when that on-air light went off and it was televised, I remember personally going, my stomach dropping. Oh, Jesus. Is it true? Are we not coming back? And then a couple of days later, I don't remember the exact time frame, Bernie called me and said, "Listen, Lauren's not coming back." And then none of us came back. And so in answer to your question, we had our ear to the ground going, "Gee, is it going to happen? Is it not going to happen?" Meaning the end. And shortly afterwards found out that he was leaving. So we all left.
Yeah, and that's sort of the testament to, you know, who Lorne is about the face of television. Apart from those 5 years, the first with Gene Domanian and the rest are Dick Ebersol, like he did, what is it, it's 45 years now. So he's done 40 of those 45 years. And, you know, he's really shaped that show. And you think, sure, you can talk about standouts like Eddie Murphy and, you know, Joe Piscopo and those other casts when he wasn't there. But just the people that he's involved in, it, you know, what is that, trillions of dollars of box office revenue and TV.
It's unbelievable. You know, up in Jamestown, New York, they built the National Comedy Center. And if you go there, which I recommend to anybody who's a fan of comedy, it's not a Hall of Fame. It's a comedy museum, if you will. Yeah, so you'll see memorabilia like Harpo Marx's trench coat and all of George Carlin's handwritten notes and things. But it's so interactive. You type in a name and you just see all the people that person worked with. You can call up any comedy sketch from any era. You can call up any episode of any sitcom. Carl Reiner gave all of his archival things to them. So I think you're talking to Norman Lear. So it's just growing and growing and growing. It's only been open for about 2 years. And the reason I mention it is if you put in SNL, what comes up, like I said before, the genealogy of not even so much box office, and I'm sure they have that, is who that show begat and put out into the world. And they affected television, and they affected movies and Broadway, and now Netflix live streaming, and it's just astounding. It is astounding.
Yeah, and there's so many instances of, you know, people will forget, you know, Julia Louis-Dreyfus was on for a number of years. Robert Downey Jr. was on for a year. You know, there's all these people that Ben Stiller did like three shows, you know. So
Anthony Michael Hall, yeah. I mean, Randy Quaid.
Yeah.
So you talk about the people that it's almost a footnote because they're big stars in their own right, like Ben. But it's almost a footnote. Oh, yeah, he was there for a couple of shows.
Right. And you get a lot of like people that were writers that you never even realized, you know, in later years, people talk about him differently now, but Louis C.K. was a writer and it just didn't work. Somebody like Sarah Silverman was on camera. It didn't work. And then you see people who are good in other roles.
Adam McKay.
Yeah.
Adam McKay. Right.
Yeah.
I mean, my God. So it's just astounding, isn't it?
Yeah, no, exactly. Yeah, Adam McKay was there during the era that I interned. And so, like, you know, I'm like, oh, that's the guy who makes like The Big Short and all these movies. Anyway, I've been very stingy with your time, Alan, but you have been very generous with it. We've talked for
that's
about 90 minutes.
That's the difference between the two of us. You see, that's where we differ. Yeah. I'm generous and you just take.
I just take. But here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to write you a check for $7 and I think we'll be
Wow. Wow. Okay, good. No, we're good.
And I'll mention the book title one last time, Laugh Lines, My Life, Helping Funny People Be Funnier, Alan Zweibel. It's a great book. There's so much more to dive into. Are you online? Are you on social media at all? Or should they just look for the book and they'll find everything?
Look for the book.
There?
You know, you can get it on my website, alanzweibel.com. You can go straight to Amazon and get it there. It's gettable. It came out a couple of days ago, and it's, I guess, right now, people are looking for something that's a diversion and maybe a couple of laughs because it's doing very well right out of the box.
Yeah, and this is a perfect diversion. If you love SNL, you love comedy, this is a great book. And look, you can get your books digitally. If you don't want to open the mail, you know, you can still get it that way.
Yeah. So open your Kindle. It'll be right there.
It's right there. You can get it right now. Anyway, Alan, thank you so much. I've been Christian Blatt, and I'm sure that the ladies will be back as soon as there's a new episode of SNL. You'll see Steph and Amy then. If you want to keep in touch with me, I'm on Twitter and Instagram at ChristianDMZ. And the show I referenced earlier that I produce and co-host is The Dennis Miller Option on Westwood One. And I have my own podcast called The Blattcast, BLADTCAST.com for more info. That is all the time now. Thanks again to Alan Zweibel, and we will see you all soon. Thanks.
Our founder, Kevin Undergaro, and me, Maria Menounos, would like to thank you for tuning in to AfterBuzz TV. Remember, we're not just the first, we're the biggest in the world, and we're the only destination for all your favorite TV shows. Whatever you crave, we've got it. So go to AfterBuzzTV.com and check out our lineup. Buzz you later.
The views expressed herein are those of the hosts only and do not necessarily reflect the views of AfterBuzz TV or its owners or principals.